Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort, meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today. That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
Welcome to Oh God, What Now? I'm Dorian Linsky. Hello again. It's good to be back from book leave. And the right have put on a show for me. This week on the podcast, the National Conservatism Conference, which people have conveniently been abbreviating to NATC, gives us a glimpse of a Tory party in opposition, but will Britain buy what they're selling? Meanwhile, Brexit MPs scream betrayal at one of their biggest cheerleaders, Kemi Badenoch, after she climbs down on the retained EU law bill. Will her disgraceful bias towards reality hurt her leadership prospects? And in the spoiler-packed extra bit for Patreon backers, in this week's Succession, American democracy is in the hands of the Roy family. What could possibly go wrong? Let's meet the panel. First up, commentator Alex Andreou. Hello, Alex.
Hello, Dorian. So nice to have you back.
Thank you very much. Nice to be back. Turkey's election is heading for a second round at the end of this month. Erdogan is being blamed for 44% inflation. Yikes. And a disorganized response to the earthquake in February. He's one of those guys that's been around forever and seemed like he might arrange things so that he was indeed around forever.
Yeah.
Could this be the end? Like, what's the opposition looking like in the second round?
So it's unlikely, unfortunately, despite what the polls were showing, despite the economic collapse in Turkey, despite the reaction to the earthquake, the areas that were most affected by the earthquake actually voted for Erdogan by more than 60%. It's just extraordinary. So Turkish elections are like the French presidential election. So unless someone gets above the 50%, there is then a second round runoff between the top two contenders. So Erdogan ended up the first round with 41.5%, and his challenger Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, say that when you're drunk.
I can't say it when I'm sober.
He was around 45%, although there are still loads of overseas votes being counted. And so Erdogan goes into the second round, which is on the 20th of May, really the clear favorite. Turkey's united opposition has said they have found loads of irregularities in thousands of ballot boxes, they've lodged complaints, etc., but they have conceded that they don't think that affected the results significantly that. So I think they're doing the responsible thing and trying to avoid a situation that means civil unrest leading into the second round. The Election Observer, which is the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, is highlighting loads of flaws in the run-up to the election. I think that's what's more significant. So Erdogan and the ruling parties basically enjoyed a glorious soaping across the media and news channels, which are mostly owned by Erdogan and Erdogan's people.
So it's quite succession-y then.
Yeah. And the areas where the earthquake took place, apparently there's been loads of stuff that has basically not disenfranchised, but not done enough for people who are now without a home because of the earthquake to be able to vote. And so all of those things are having an effect. But sadly, it looks as if Erdogan is the favorite going in. A lot will depend on when the third person's votes will go to. And he's a hard ethno-nationalist. But weirdly, he's also a very committed secularist. And so they won't go automatically to Erdogan, who is very religious and getting more so as he gets older in his approach to government. They might go to the opponent. We'll see.
Rachel Wearmouth is the deputy political editor of The New Statesman. Hi, Rachel.
Hello.
Nigel Farage said on Newsnight that Brexit has failed, literally those words, which is obviously delightful for us. But I mean, is this what he obviously did not say Brexit was a terrible idea, I'm sorry. Is this what he was always going to say because he had no power over the execution? Like, is this almost, is in a sense a sort of a non-story because Farage could never be seen to say, oh yeah, it's been a great success, but I wasn't involved?
It's intriguing, isn't it? I think because it's Nigel Farage, you can never rule out just a little bit of attention seeking.
it worked.
and there's certainly, that's certainly something he's been doing a little bit more recently. You know, he's kind of flirting with the idea of potentially making yet another return to politics. But I think the timing of such a big admission, because coming from him, you know, one of the main architects of Brexit, as it, the timing of this comes after the local elections when the Conservative Party's in massive crisis. So you suggest that this has been said for some kind of political advantage. You know, he's obviously very connected to Reform. I think he's an honorary president, I think is his title with Reform. They got about 6 councillors at the local elections. You know, they kind of, despite polling, you know, I think it was about 6% or something going up to the local elections, they didn't really break through. So I think this is something in relation to political positioning of some kind. So perhaps, you know, he can claim that if Brexit had been done properly, then it wouldn't, you know, it would be a huge success, which helps Reform to set out its agenda of cutting taxes, basically, and kind of trying to get that onto the agenda in the months ahead.
You could always guess, couldn't you, on the day after the referendum that we would be hearing real Brexit has never been tried. That was the destiny.
Yeah, and I mean, it's distancing Reform from Brexit and from the, you know, potentially the high level of taxes that we're seeing at the minute.
Matt Green is a political satirist and comedian who's just announced dates for his debut tour, That Guy. Hello, Matt.
Hello, how are you doing?
I'm fine. Liz Truss, remember her?
Yeah.
she was the other one at the coronation.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is on a trip to Taiwan this week, despite having no brief. She told the Taiwanese delegation that invited her that there is no meaningful deterrence without hard power. There's a lot more hawkish on China than Sunak has been. What do you think she's doing? I mean, we're all have periods of drift in our careers.
Yeah. It feels to me like in her short tenure as prime minister, she killed a queen and an economy. And now she's going for like the triple threat of starting a war. That's the one thing she didn't have time to do. She was only there for a few weeks. You know, she did do some pretty big stuff, but she didn't actually get that involved in foreign policy. So it feels like that's what she's after now, that she's got that final thing that she hasn't quite pressed that button.
I have a certain admiration for her sort of response to massive humiliation and career destruction.
Yeah.
Because I would feel quite down and I would retreat probably from the public
eye.
Yeah,
but you're not thick.
For a bit. But she's got a lot of gusto.
Yeah, every time I look at Liz Truss, I think there is someone who needs a bit more imposter syndrome.
Well, she has the opposite.
Yeah, whatever that is, she just has like, she looks at her, so she's got the opposite of like body dysmorphia. She's kind of like, she's got brilliance dysmorphia. Every time she looks at herself in the mirror, she's like, I am brilliant. I don't know what all this stuff is about. I'm great at this.
It's very much it's the Yeats line, isn't it, about the best lack all conviction while the worst are Liz Truss.
I think.
Before we get started, a quick word from Alex.
Next week, we're back in the flesh at the Leicester Square Theatre. On Wednesday, May 24th, join me, Roz, Arthur and Marie doing her first live show. Tickets are on sale now and selling fast. Go to leicestersquaretheatre.com to book your spot. Patreon backers get a discount. Check your inbox.
Right, more Yeats now. What rough beast, it's our come at last, slouches towards the Natural History Museum to be born. It's the National Conservatism Conference, with an absolute rogues gallery of Tory hardliners and thought leaders, such as Douglas Murray, David Starkey, Melanie Phillips, and good old Matt Goodwin, sharing their ideas on the heteronormative family and indulging in some Enoch Powell cosplay. The Conservative Democracy Organisation Conference over the weekend was just the Bring Back Bojo fan club. But is this one bigger and stranger than Tory party politics? Our own Seth Tavoe actually went along, God help him, and he's telling Andrew Harrison about it.
Seth Tabor, you covered the National Conservatism Conference for Open Democracy. In fact, you infiltrated it. The website had not been accredited for press, had it? How did you do this?
Yeah, that's right. Well, we knew that these three news organizations had all been turned away. Mm-hmm. And I got a note from my editor earlier that morning saying, are you still planning on going? Well, I thought we weren't. So I thought I'd just try my chance. Yeah. I rocked up, blazer, cufflinks.
Did you have to say the password like, oh, you know, Nazism, not all bad, or something like that?
Well, the password was just the story I made up about thinking I wouldn't be in the country and I missed my flight to Marbella, but now I'm here, so I might as well come in. Have you got room for a little one?
Yes.
and, you know, because I thought nothing unites national conservatives quite like spending large amounts of time outside the country. And, yeah, it was music to their ears. And they said, come in just for one session.
So you said once inside you saw, and I quote here, no shortage of wackadoodlery. What were you expecting? What did you actually see in this epochal event?
I'm not sure I knew what to expect because they haven't had one of these since before the pandemic and it would be, you know, a change of culture. But it was basically a Trump rally or an Orban rally. It felt very much more like an American-style libertarian conservative event. I've been to loads of Conservative Party conferences over the years. I know that you can have a bit of a weird fringe sometimes, but by and large, these are normal, healthy, mainstream events to some degree or other. This was something else. This was really weird. And what I tended to focus on, because I'd already seen some early coverage focusing on speeches, focusing on what, you know, Jacob Rees-Mogg, Suella Braverman had said, I actually found the delegates more interesting and more alarming. I was much more interested in what really ticks their boxes, what really made them react and pipe up with excitement.
So what did make them pipe up with excitement?
Mention of guns. When a US senator mentioned assault rifles being at an event, that got a spontaneous burst of applause. Mention of hormones, anything basically stigmatizing trans people, loved it, couldn't get enough of that. There were some weird things on wind farms. I mean, this whole thing about piling up dead birds everywhere. It was hysterical stuff.
I did see your quote from J.D. Vancek, I don't live in a hellscape covered in dead birds.
Yeah.
No, he wants to live in the other hellscape. those guys are going to build. You also pointed out that they seem to be strangely young.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't in some ways that surprised by that, but I know that the perception for these things, especially Conservative Party events over the last few decades, you know, having covered a fair number of these, you expect an older demographic. This is different because it's not actually set up by a UK organisation. It's being run by a US think tank. It's not correct to say that, you know, they've bussed in supporters or anything like that, but they've advertised it internationally. It's clearly got an international following, you know, people from Copenhagen and Brussels as well as from London, lots of Americans as well as UK students. And it really is sort of 20-somethings. The feel of the place was slightly anemic, socially awkward, you know, shy conservatives who aren't used to being amongst people who agree with them and suddenly being let loose in this echo chamber.
This is because I'm ancient, so I can remember things like the Federation of Conservative Students, which would be full of people exactly like that, who were forever getting caught out by accidentally saying things like, oh, I don't know, Germany mucked up nationalism, for example, like Douglas Murray said this time. Just to wrap it up, though, I mean, are we making a mistake talking so much about this? Because it didn't seem to be massively oversubscribed from the pictures I saw.
I don't know. I think, firstly, a lot of the pictures focused on the front rather than the back, and actually most people were at the back. There were about 300 people in the hall. It was a respectably attended conference. I think the problem is that 5-6 years ago, you were seeing things like Trump rallies that were an object of derision, and people saying, oh, look at this novelty, look at this bit of fun, or just covering it like it was a normal political event. What I think makes a lot more sense is covering this almost as a sociologist. This is not normal. This is not even healthy. If you look at some of the things being said, which are really far out there, they do need to be covered. They do need to be acknowledged, but in the right sort of way, framed as this is not part of our normal healthy discourse. This is a radical departure.
Rachel, 3 years ago, Daniel Kaczynski was reprimanded by the Tories for attending the NatCon conference in Rome. Now we have the likes of Mogg, Braverman and Michael Gove in attendance. Why did Sunak let them go? Is it just simply, is he fine with it or does he have no power to say no?
Oh, I think sort of both of those things are maybe partly true here. So there's a myth that Rishi Sunak is a one nation conservative and a moderate within his party. That's like not necessarily the case. I think so. Even by appointing someone like Suella Braverman as Home Secretary, and Number 10 has said that they passed her speech before she got up and said all the things she said about immigration, the culture wars and what have you. He's signalling that even by appointing her, he's signalling he's quite right wing when it comes to crime, when it comes to immigration when it comes to culture war issues. The line from number 10 at the minute certainly is that he's okay with it to some degree. But, you know, a lot of it is very much undermining him as well. You know, Suella Braverman, some of the things she said about immigration, it was like the Home Secretary standing there and saying, this is how I think the Home Secretary should do her job when it comes to limiting legal migration. So I find it hard to believe that number 10 is also just comfortable with that kind of speech. So there's also kind of another theory, which is that given the position the Conservatives in, they probably want to talk to a number of different constituencies within the country. You know, some of them, you know, for example, like Jeremy Hunt might be more at home in blue wall constituencies in the home counties or what have you, but they also have other people who were part of their 29 coalition that are more sceptical of immigration, who are not so socially liberal, and they need to find ways to communicate with them as well. So it may be part of a pretty desperate electoral strategy also.
You're very much more polite about those people than I can manage. That was deftly done. Michael Gove was probably the least extreme guest. What was he doing there? Is he have I got him wrong as well? Is he just like far more extreme than I thought?
I think my interpretation of why Michael Gove was there, I think he was very much there to provide like a counter argument to Suella Braverman's tirade, I think. You know, his position was that the Conservatives can't win the elections on culture wars and they have to win on the economy. He said he was himself was a social liberal, and he kind of didn't want to go into things like criticising the Archbishop for his position on, you know, saying that the illegal immigration bill was immoral. And I think the way I saw it was like a rebuke to Suella Braverman, and therefore I think you have to assume that he was there on behalf of Kemi Badenoch, who's the business and trade secretary. You know, he's the person that Michael Gove backed for the last leadership, and who you assume that he's still quite keen on taking the job after Rishi Sunak. And I think that's what a lot of this conference has been about. It's been about, you know, people using it as a platform for the next leadership race, which is just, it's the kind of conversation that a party would have with itself while it's in opposition, not when it's in government. You know, it's really bizarre.
I think mentally it is in opposition already. You wrote a piece for the NS called Why Suella Braverman is Unsackable, which is a chilling phrase. Briefly, why is that?
Well, I think one of the main reasons is just is pretty basic, really, is that he made her Home Secretary 6 months ago, and if he was to sack her now, it would say something about his judgment and not her. I think that makes it hard for him in the first instance. I think she also has a base within the Conservative Party, you know, like the ERG, and he needs to keep them very, very sweet. So it's all kind of delicately balanced, and he can't move against her at this point. That's not to say that a lot of his Conservative Party colleagues don't want him to. You know, a lot of people, as I understand it, went to the Whip's office in the last couple of days and have been saying, look, Rishi, enough is enough. She has to go. She's undermining you and making you look weak. How long he can kind of keep her in place is another question, I think. And you have to wonder, if once you move towards the election and you kind of interpret some of the results from the local elections, you'd have to wonder whether he can continue to afford to have someone as extreme as Suella Braverman in post, really.
Alex, Melanie Phillips published a piece in The Times with the amazing headline, National Conservatism is Not a Fascist Plot. Which raises more questions than it answers. Yes.
No one really says that when it's not a fascist plot, do they?
It's like the League of Gentlemen line. Yeah. We didn't burn him.
That's exactly right.
But it's easy to use the F word here.
What F word would that be?
Well, it's the one that comes after faith, family, flag. Right. The one that probably they don't want to mention. But would Orbanism be a better comparison for what's going for this kind of rhetoric?
I'm keenly aware that you've devoted considerable time on origin story on this subject, so I'm very conscious.
No, man. You have a free hit.
I'm genuinely not sure, and I don't think that trying to define it is a pressing issue, actually. It is what it is. And I think because it's such an unnatural creature of sort of American imported culture wars trying to impose themselves on the UK public, it may be entirely sui generis. And we might waste a hell of a lot of time trying to find a word for it. like to give an example, I think you mentioned an origin story that one of the usual elements of that kind of authoritarianism is a sort of titanic figure at the top, this sort of strongman figure that becomes the conduit for the force of the state. And if you look at Tea Party in the United States, for about a decade, it was an ideology in search of that leader,
right, yeah,
in
yeah.
many ways. So that's what worries me. I think that's what we're seeing here. We're seeing an ideology looking for its Trump over here. And I find it deeply concerning. I mean, I think Rachel was absolutely right. It involves an implicit admission that the Conservatives are going to lose the next election and lose badly, because none of it is about Sunak right now. None of it is about policy right now. All of it is about positioning after a bad loss next election, right? And that worries me, because this is not about what government we get next time. It's about what government we get the time after that.
Well, you raised this point. The sort of Americanisms there.
Yeah.
And interestingly, in the social media, in the Twitter feed, they keep spelling words like center and humor in American way. It suggests that an American is doing the Twitter
really,
feed.
Really, really old strange.
Because it's the work of a US think tank called the Edmund Burke Foundation. You can guess its political leanings. has held events around the US and Europe in recent years, like the one that Kaczynski went to in Rome. So it's really an international affair. And they keep talking about things like critical race theory, religious education, things that sound very like Ron DeSantis. And it's called national conservatism. But did you find it weirdly un-British?
Completely.
And very online.
Completely. And what is on top of that is that you've had this almost carpet bombing of think pieces in all the right-wing press from people ranging from the likes of Fraser Nelson complaining about fact-checking and how this is the new sort of woke thing that will tie us down, to previously sane people like Tom McTagg, who's now decided to become a sort of professional alt-right contrarian, going, why not? What's so strange about national conservatism? And it's like, look at it, man. It is fucking strange. It's absolutely an American import and looks it from a mile off. And the number of people actively trying to make it a thing, like actively trying to get the country to wear it, is the thing that really frightens me, because it's obviously quite organized, quite concerted, and it's got a lot of money behind it.
Yeah, the Tom McTague piece, I should say, he's talking about national conservatism almost like in terms of like Disraeli, and that conservatism is interested in the nation.
Yeah,
but that's very different.
Because the Conservative Party is swimming with Disraeli.
It's very
at the
different
moment.
To sort of uppercase N, uppercase C national conservatism, which literally this is the first time it's had a UK conference. It's not a UK. It's not British creation.
Yeah,
at all.
It's Fashtonbury.
Matt, I'm going to give you some lowlights.
Sure.
Yeah, in case you have not been glued to your screen. Miriam Cates, MP, worried about low birth rates and cultural Marxism. Catherine Birbal Singh reprimanded Whitney Houston for the lyrics of The Greatest Love of All, which Whitney Houston did not write. But anyway, do not let the children lead the way, she said. She also missed the bit about teach them well. So I don't know if that's a confession. Danny Kruger said that Western civilization is threatened by a new religion, a mix of Marxism, narcissism, and paganism, conforming to the dystopian fantasy of John Lennon, which really means imagine rather than I'm the walrus.
Yeah.
It's also a dystopian fantasy if you're scared of walruses. will the next leader of the Tory party be a Jordan Peterson podcast?
It definitely feels like that. I mean, I have found this week quite stressful having to research this, because the problem with this conference has been that it's not been live. Like, you can't actually watch it live streamed anywhere. It's all just for the people in the room. I look quite hard. I don't think there is any way of watching it live. And so you just get the clips, and you just get these mad clips of like, you know, of like one sentence from this speech, where it's deliberately the most provocative, weird thing. And then people obviously respond to that going, what is this provocative, weird thing? And then you get other people going, oh, you got that out of context. You didn't see the context. It's like, yeah, because there is no context. You haven't given us the context. And it's the most obvious case of something, a phrase I heard a few weeks ago and made a video about, called rage farming, where particularly right-wing conservatives, they put deliberately provocative things up, deliberately for people like us on the left and the centre to go, what is this? This is nonsense. And it just increases their reach and engagement. And it's about giving them more attention than they would have otherwise. And they sort of know it. Like the joke that Douglas Murray made about you know, the second, the Germans mucked up nationalism.
Holocaust, what a boo-boo.
Yeah, exactly. And the thing is, it's obviously a deliberately stupid sort of provocative joke. I don't really, you know, nobody really thinks he actually is underplaying it, but he's doing it deliberately to make everyone go, he's underplaying the Holocaust. And it's this sort of horrible cycle that just, they say something stupid and provocative and we go, that's stupid. And they go, ah, but you're not listening to the context. And we're going, but there is no context. It's deliberately provocative.
I mean, you've just got to believe that they believe that, though. Like, we're not on here. I don't know what the equivalent would be for us. Yeah. We're not like under, because it's not like we're a communist podcast.
Can I tell the listeners to go and watch Matt's latest video, because it was exactly in the Miriam Cates thing, and it made me do a genuine Danny Thomas spit take when he called for more conservative babies to fight the Marxists between naps.
But this is the thing. There's this weird sort of contradiction in, at the moment, where they're desperate for more babies, but they hate young people. So it's that sort of like, we've got to get the babies and then at some point stop them becoming young people somehow.
I think like in, for listeners who have seen Guardians of the Galaxy 3, there's a kind of tube that you put these little babies into and suddenly they kind of grow into these giant mutations. So I think the idea is that you put the newborn baby in there and then just grows into Tim Stanley in like seconds and just misses out the bit where you're a young person who
might a frightening thought.
You might be into the left.
The thing I found most bizarre about it, though, is that, and in some ways I think this is probably partly what Alex was saying about they're looking for a leader, is that with almost no exceptions, they are terrible speakers. They just can't do it. They can't present. They're kind of wonkish academics who are obviously not used to being in front of an audience. All these kind of mad politicians who just sound swivel-eyed and strange. And then you've got Catherine Burbulsing, who does this weirdly ranty speech where she sort of starts shouting at the audience, do you love your country enough to tweet under your own name, from someone who doesn't tweet under her own name, which is, you know,
yeah,
funny.
And she called like Miss Snuffy.
Snuffy.
I think that's because what Matt was saying was right. It's designed for clicks. It's superficial. It's fake. And therefore, it feels weird. And I think that it's because it's designed to kind of be spread as far as possible and be controversial as possible. And you feel like a lot of their hearts maybe probably aren't in it, really. They're just kind of trying to make sure they have the best reach possible for some of their ideas.
Well, this is what puzzles me, Rachel, because as a nationalist, how much is this about, you know, the future of the Tory party, and how much is it a form of trolling? Because they don't like large sections of the British population, clearly. And it doesn't seem like any kind of political platform for a mainstream party. Do you think some of them have imagined, I'm thinking maybe someone like Lord Frost, imagined a silent majority that doesn't actually exist? Or are they only concerned with a very noisy GB News-ish minority? That's where I get confused, because if they're trying to disseminate the weirdest, crankiest stuff, like just attacking pop songs and Marxist conspiracies, like what's this for? I can see what it's like for the grift. It's probably great for the careers of some of the pundits. But how does that help the Tories?
Well, I think it's like fantasy politics, isn't it? And it's a fantasy because it's ignoring two of the things that matter. The two things that matter most to people, which is the cost of living crisis and public services. You know, those things just were not part of any of the conversations that I've seen so far. You know, there's just no engagement on the central issues for people. So therefore, it is this weird, dislocated kind of movement. But it's also the analysis of the country they're talking about, their analysis is based on, you know, things that haven't happened yet. It's like they're talking about a Conservative Party loss that they're responding to and interpreting, which hasn't happened yet. They haven't had a verdict from voters as to why, you know, the voters don't want the Conservatives anymore. They're kind of just blaming a load of people and hoping that blame gets picked up by somebody. It's bizarre. They're kind of disowning a lot of their own political history as well. Like Miriam Cates, for example, saying, you know, the two child limit put off people having kids. I mean, yeah, obviously. That was obviously a George Osborne policy. And then you had, you know, Danny Kruger, he blamed Thatcher for hollowing out industry. But then also went on to blame, you know, George Osborne and David Cameron for failing to do anything to reverse it. So it was kind of like a disowning of their record, and including the record that includes this period in government. It was, I just found it so hard to fathom of what like the end game is with this, really.
Matt, on that note, Matt Goodwin appeared at one point to blame the left for Margaret Thatcher and neoliberalism, which I'm old enough to remember was not the case. What do you think? What is the left to these people? Because it seems at the same time to be this dogmatic and scary religion / ideology. I've noticed this happens a lot on the right. You have to wokeism, woke ideology. It's a new faith, etc., etc. I don't have been sent any of the rules, so I'm not following it very well. And on the other hand, it's this sort of endlessly morphing bogeyman, which includes Margaret Thatcher. Like so they need an enemy. But normally, traditionally, authoritarians and fascists, they chose an enemy. Like, you knew who they were having a go at. Here, I actually have no idea who are they punching at?
Well, every time I see Matthew Goodwin, it always makes me think of Godwin's Law, is the idea that any internet conversation will eventually become about the Nazis. And I always think there's an equivalent, which is Goodwin's Law, which is that anyone I disagree with is a Nazi, essentially. That's his sort of, like, is the elite. And it's also, I think it's also like anyone, I think often Goodwin's Law in my mind is we have to think like fascists to stop fascists winning. That seems to be his sort of, like, we have to do all
this
stuff.
You made me do it.
Yeah, if we didn't do all this stuff, then the really bad people would do it. And you go, but you are still doing the same, you know, you're still having those thoughts. And yeah, I think basically it's anyone who disagrees with him. I think also something you said earlier about is it very online? There is one tweet that I saw today, Wednesday, from David Frost's speech, and it had the word humour in it, which is why it struck me. And it said, apparently there's a quote from his speech, which is, "We're accused of not having a sense of humour," spelt wrong. "But if you look through the Twitter feeds of the left, they are the most humourless people in the country," which did feel like a direct attack on me, it has to be said.
I think that's who you meant, yeah.
But that for me is genuinely, that is what... That's who the enemy is. It's people who are mean to them on Twitter. That feels like that's they've got so obsessed with the social media and the culture war that they think that's who is important, and it's just not.
It's definitely an older person thing as well. People have grown up on Twitter, so almost have more context. Mm. But older people that got like very, very, very into Twitter, and that's who their opponent. He said our opponents, not the left, but our opponents.
Yes, yeah.
So it's this constant online, and it's just like, log off.
Yeah, yeah.
Lord.
It's like just blaming everybody, though, isn't it? It's like the civil service, it's schools, it's, you know, it's ultimately like the people of the country.
It's progress as well. It's just blaming the future. Like there was another guy who said today something about, well, I'll find it. Oh, yeah. He said, we should be returning power to the phone book. I thought, that's what does that mean?
Fuck does
but also,
mean?
That's like, there what? Haven't been phone books for years. What are you talking about? It's madness.
Well, on the future, guys.
But it's already at the stage of blaming the people, because when Braverman turns around and says, why aren't we training people to pick fruit? And, you know, and people are saying that people shouldn't get benefits unless they go pick fruit. That is the natural extension, that the country is in this state because you're not doing your bit. Mm. You're not having babies, you white woman specifically. Mm. You're not going out to pick fruit when we need it. You know, so it is entirely becoming that.
Well, this is my analysis of this, the diagnosis of the error that they've made, is because they think it's America, where actually you can, using this language, speak to a large percentage of the population, and they've applied it to a country where it actually speaks to a very small percentage of the population. And so it's classic unpopulism.
Yeah. I wouldn't underestimate it, though, Dorian, if you look at where the small boat crossings issue was as a priority in people's minds, you know, 2 years ago, it was fucking nowhere to be seen.
You know, I'm not complacent.
When you drip, drip, drip that poison into people's ears, it does finally, you know, penetrate.
Eventually
through.
They will hate, yeah. Imagine. Alex, finally, I just wanted to say one thing that was barely mentioned was Brexit.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it?
Despite its success, do you think that this basically says that it was just like an on-ramp for ethno-nationalism for these
for these people.
It was.
They can't squeeze any more juice out of that.
It was. And I said so at the time. I had massive arguments. I wrote a big piece specifically sort of talking to the people who were supporting Lexit to say, what the fuck do you think you're doing? Mm. Who is leading this movement? How do you see it leading the country to a more leftwards direction? It was the underpants gnomes. We get the underpants, profit. and so they're not mentioning Brexit because it's a palpable failure. Everyone gets it now. The country hates it. You know, its popularity is bottoming out in the polls. Even Nigel Farage says it's a shit show. So they don't want to be associated with it. So they retreat to the position, this is bigger than Brexit. It always was.
Time for another listener question in But Your Emails. Keep them coming in, by the way. This week, Anne Finley says, my appalling namesake, Anne Widdecombe, thinks a cheese sandwich is a luxury that poor people shouldn't waste money on. What does the panel advise lower-income people should put on their sandwiches to save money? Presumably that is not... There is another question behind that question, I'm guessing.
You're looking at me, I think, as the foodie of the group. Is that right? Yeah. I have given this a lot of thought. So you take two cards, all of which we hold, a couple of slices of sovereignty, chop up some control, you mix it with 350 million for NHS and apply a liberal squeeze of they need us more than we need them, and you still have a shit sandwich.
Very good. Thank
Very you. Good. I thank you.
Hard to follow that.
Rachel, what did you make of this let them not eat sandwiches outburst?
I haven't seen this clip in full, I have to admit. I've only seen some of the quotes that have come out of it from Anne Widdecombe. But I mean, again, it's one of these things that, like, you just wonder is just to kind of generate fake debate around whether or not cheese is expensive or whatever. I just found it bizarre, really. And again, just like a pretty... like hostile and hateful thing to say. I mean, who doesn't like a cheese buddy? Who doesn't like a cheese toastie? For
and it's
say?
Like there's not many. It's not like a kind of truffle sandwich. Like cheese, it's quite basic. And somebody else, there was another Tory MP going, well, "Have you tried value beans?" as if there's people going, "Well, I hadn't actually because I'm wedded.
I'd never.
I'm wedded to Heinz." And it keeps. Wasn't Lee Anderson a
Well, this is the thing. Yeah. Like that. It might be a Lee Anderson thing. It might be a 30p Lee thing. It's like, what's the worst cheese you could possibly buy for the least money or whatever?
Matt, because the whole thing is, it's just like they keep coming out and going, "Have you tried cheaper food?" as if nobody's, as if this is like a hack.
Yeah,
like one weird trick.
Yeah, poor people are walking around Harrods going, "This is too expensive."
Please, going
if only
up with
there
like,
a way to yeah, buy like, an onion that didn't cost £4.
Tins of foie gras going. Is anyone who's good with the economy? Yeah. Can someone help me? I'm my family.
Just big Waitroses full of nurses going, "I can't afford this."
Matt, do you have recommendations? I remember it was a student. I used to eat crisp sandwiches.
I was going to say, I loved a crisp sandwich as a student. Although
I love a Watsit sandwich.
A Watsit sandwich?
Have you not had a Watsit sandwich?
No, I don't think I ever have.
That's real cheese. Is tremendous.
But not Watsits.
Yeah.
It has to be the cheap version of that.
Obviously.
Or Howsits.
Yeah, I loved it. That was my, whenever I'd had like a bad gig when I started doing comedy, many years ago, I would always come home and have a crisp sandwich. That made me feel better.
That's a lot of crisp sandwiches.
I know. I had too many crisp sandwiches. I had to stop eventually after my first few years. But I was thinking about it, thinking because I actually looked it up, and apparently inflation on crisps has gone up a lot in the last few years, as it has with lots of things because of potatoes and stuff, as well as shrinkflation because you get less in a bag. So I was thinking, other option, sawdust. Put a bit of salt on sawdust. It'll taste as crispy as a crisp sandwich. And I'm sure wood is a carbohydrate in some way. It feels like it should be.
I found there was a, I think Kay Burley literally put out a tweet going, what do you think? Should people be finding eating cheaper sandwiches?
I saw that. Yeah. What do you think?
It's an interesting conversation.
I mean, even Marie Antoinette had the good fucking grace to suggest an alternative, albeit an ill-thought one. And Whittingham is saying, just eat nothing.
It's just a weird thing for the aspirational Tory party. They're going, like, a cheese sandwich is too aspirational.
Yeah.
Know your place. It's just... I found it wildly offensive.
And cheese sandwiches are the basic. That is what a lot of people have for lunch. You know, that is our. It feels like coming after Kit Kats or English breakfasts. It's an odd choice of thing to go. You shouldn't be allowed that.
Because avocado, stick it to avocado. Yeah, I mean, that's an easy target because they're woke. They're grown in woke farms.
Exactly.
One Tory right star who did not appear at the NatCon party was Kemi Badenoch, away on business. Might have been bad timing anyway, because on the leadership campaign trail, Rishi Sunak promised to take a shredder to the EU regulations still retained in UK law after Brexit in his first 100 days, that glorious period. After 205 days, the minister in charge of the shredder announced there would be no great repealing after all. She's promising that 600 laws will be written out of the UK's rulebook instead of the 4,000 that were promised. Alex, I was surprised that Brexiters did not say, fair enough, that was absurdly unrealistic goal. You're obviously on our side. And we shouldn't turn on you just for facing up to reality. They didn't do that. Mm-hmm. In your loyally opinion, ex-loyally opinion, was that target of 4,000 literally impossible or just extremely disastrous? Like, what, given that Badenoch obviously did not want to climb down on this for political reasons, what was the reality that was facing her?
So weirdly, it was both, because it was impossible to do in a rational way. It was impossible to actually review all those pieces of legislation and think, what do we put in its place and what are going to be the consequences and what's the impact assessment on this? So that was impossible. Mm. But that idiotic automatic sunset clause meant it would happen anyway. So it's like you had marked loads of pieces of legislation for death without anything to replace them. In lawyerly language, we call that a lacuna. And they were proposing to basically create a lacuna, the size and depth of the Pacific Ocean, which would pass the cost to private businesses to kind of frantically try and work out what the fuck is the regulatory framework within which I'm working right now in my sector.
Yeah.
That's what they were doing. They were going, yeah, you sort it out.
So
we don't know.
Is there a pragmatic path to 600? Like, has she, because that is it's a serious reduction. Is that a manageable amount by the end of the year?
They won't do that. They won't do that. They will concentrate on one or two things. We've already had a little bit of a sort of taste that they will just trample worker protections. They will concentrate on working hours directive and stuff like
that. There's your Lexit.
Yeah. Yes. Well done. What's the name of that twat from the firefighters union? They will basically just copy and paste loads of stuff across and concentrate on one or two big things that they can tout as wins.
Rachel, she's clearly in a fight with the Brexit fanatics. But did she consciously pick one? Like, because we always assume that everything is political manoeuvring. But was this just a case of looking at her brief and going, this is an impossible thing and I'm not going to do it?
I think sort of the more interesting question is how she ended up with that bill in particular. It's kind of cross-government responsibility. So you'd think that it would have fallen into the lap of the Cabinet Office Minister Oliver Dowden, but it didn't. It was decided that Kemi Badenoch was going to do it. I mean, I don't know if that's because he refused or if Rishi Sunak thought that she should do it. But I think, you know, if you're, you know, sort of thinking about things from Kemi Badenoch's perspective, then I think it probably doesn't hurt her to look like she's facing down Brexiteers some of the time, because again, it depends what narrative comes out of the election defeat. If it's one that's a vote, you know, rejecting some of the impact of Brexit or whatever, then she's going to have look like that she's she was already starting to deal with that problem. And I think one of the ways in which she's kind of trying to sell herself is like some kind of problem solver. You know, I mean, she's in Switzerland trying to currently soften some of the post Brexit trading relationships, and so that's kind of, it seems like she's trying to develop that as her brand, like a sort of an independent thinker or a problem solver. You know, so I think there's definitely some political manoeuvring in there.
Yeah, it's a funny one because you would think that she wanted a brief where she could do more of her culture warring, which she's very keen on. Do you think it helps, Bernard, that she's in a sort of grown-up job where she's not just throwing red meat left, right and centre?
Yeah, there was a rumour around a while ago that she would end up being a Home Secretary or have a different kind of job where, you know, she'd have more of that, being able to throw red meat to her own party or whatever. But I think definitely, because one of the things that she was criticised for during the last leadership race was that she didn't really have any experience. She looked, you know, like it was far too early for her to be running any kind of leadership contest. So this is how she solves it, I guess, isn't it? As business and trade is kind of covers such a massive brief, and she seems to be given every knotty problem going to kind of help her answer some of that criticism that she had during the first leadership contest. That, yeah, I think it's not harming her, put it that way.
And if the Tory right ends up having to choose between Badenoch and Braverman as their champion against Our Lady of the Sword, Penny Mordaunt, or some other normie in the next leadership race, who would you bet on? Are you pretty confident that one of them would have the edge in that scenario?
I mean, it would depend who are they. If it was just between them, I think Badenoch would probably edge it. But if it's between one of them and, you know, someone from the left of the party, I think it's very hard to say how that would turn out.
That's what I mean, though. If the right had to settle on one, who was going to be theirs against some, you know, disgraceful pinko moderate?
Yeah. I think what we've seen the last few days with this conference is kind of like there's a hint of desperation, isn't there? That like they're trying to
just a hint,
a soupçon,
yeah, a little bit, trying to kind of get people to latch onto that idea, like some kind of betrayal narrative or you know, some kind of blame culture where they might lurch for someone like Braverman, but I'd bet on Kemi Badenoch at the minute.
Matt, do you think that? The Badenoch, because I'm thinking of what she said in the leadership contest. I'm thinking of her cozying up to Ron DeSantis recently. Mm. So, I mean, she's clearly very right wing. So is Braverman kind of a gift to her? Because it's all about, as Rachel said, you know, people do generally think that Rishi Sunak is less right wing than he is, because he's always standing next to really right-wing people. And do you think the same sort of thing happens with Badenoch? The next to Braverman, anybody looks like a kind of groovy social democrat.
I think that's probably right. And next to, as you said, next to Liz Truss, she looks vaguely competent. So the two are probably working in her favour. And she said something in the House of Commons just before she got told off by the Speaker, where she said, well, if I'm annoying people on both sides of the argument, then I'm obviously doing something right. And it's the... I do feel like it is beginning to be about positioning, that she is positioning herself as slightly more centre than, as you say, Braverman, who's going full scale, you know, fascist at this, you know, conference. And Badenoch is just edging a little bit towards the centre from a very right-wing position. But I think perhaps she's being quite smart on that.
It's probably quite an obvious point, but I was listening to a podcast, I can't remember which one, it might have been a New States one, actually, where someone just said, like, Braverman's basically just a UKIP MP.
Mm.
And it was like, that was just the way to think of it. And it's like, oh yeah, clearly. Whereas Badenoch was probably still feels like
so.
She's in the Tory party.
But then the question is, a lot of it is about whether it is the job that she's doing, as you say, that is making her be reality-based. Like if you swap those two jobs around, if Braverman and Badenoch had different jobs, which could have happened, would Braverman... I mean, it's hard to see. I feel like just on instinct and just on having seen them, I feel like Braverman would be still saying the same kind of things as the business secretary, and Badenoch would be being a little bit less insane in terms of the Home Secretary brief. But it would be an interesting swap, and I almost feel like Sunak could do that just to see what happened and see he could sort of screw both of them over a bit.
Well, I haven't seen The Lord of the Rings in a while, but isn't it the ring, it corrupts you? And that's like, but that's being Home Secretary.
Yeah.
And I remember people saying, I mean, we had a discussion on here, where, who was worse, Braverman or Priti Patel?
Mm.
And I was like, it's Braverman, but we haven't seen it yet because she hasn't been Home Secretary.
Yeah.
And that's when, that's when you see it with Labour people as well, like, you know, your inner authoritarian comes out, and even people you thought were quite reasonable become, you know, like pretty horrible.
Yeah.
And the people who were horrible are just
become Gollum.
Gollum.
And it's also
it's like a character from Lord of the Rings. Yeah.
And it's just a job that's too hard. There's too many things to do. The brief is too big, and therefore they end up focusing on the bit that interests them out of that brief. And for Braverman, it's clearly the immigration bit.
But can I just say that out of this, we need to rescue some sanity, because we're doing this comparative thing of you know, is Mothra better than
Godzilla?
Godzilla. But the truth is that for a party that purports to be competent managers of the economy and the party of business, I mean, this approach, Badnock may have ended up finally in a vaguely more sane place, but this shit should never have been on the roster. It should never have gone to the stage it went. This was a drunk idea in a private members club. You know, let's just scrap them all. Just scrap them all, the laws. Yeah, if this says Europe, just scrap it. I mean, it should never have gone beyond that, right?
It's like you've got a table full of dirty dishes, and there is a temptation sometimes, rather than washing them, just like, what if I just knocked them all on the floor?
Yeah.
What if I just smashed everything and threw it away and bought new ones? And that, it was essentially that in bill form.
Yeah, and the dishes are not even dirty in this particular case. They're just from France. Well, or they come from your ex, who you hate, but they're actually really great, expensive dishes.
It reminds me a bit of the situation with Musk and Twitter, that he came in and sacked everybody and destroyed all of the verification and stuff, and then slowly over the next few weeks added bits back on and started end, and then went, oh, actually, we sort of do need that, and we sort of do need that. And it's like, well, yeah, you don't have to ruin everything and start again every time. You can do things slowly. And that used to be what the Tories were famous for, was slow, incremental
It's decisions. Kind of in the word, conservative,
exactly,
isn't it?
Yeah.
I think people maybe focus a little bit too much on Kevin Badenoch and Suella Braverman as potential leaders as well, because I think after an election defeat, everyone's going to want to think about who is going to worry, not just who's going to satisfy the members and satisfy, you know, the most extreme elements of your own party, but who's actually in some way remotely equipped to take on the Labour Party. And you'd have to look at people like James Cleverly and Penny Mordaunt for that. And I also remember, it's also would be relevant just the scale of the defeat and who's left, you know, which MPs who always have a kind of outsized impact on the leadership race, how many of them are really to the right and how many of them kind of make a different calculation.
Are you being perhaps a little optimistic about their sort of the psychology of defeat? Because I do wonder with, obviously, the Tories in 97... Well, I know maybe some people thought that William Hague was better than he was, but they certainly went off for a few years between then and Cameron with sort of unsuitable leaders. Labour after 2015 went with Corbyn, who obviously, you know, outperformed expectations in 2017, but was very much not somebody that people thought was going to take the fight to Cameron so much as something the members liked. So I suppose the assumption is that the Tories will go harder. Mm. I mean, is that, am I overstating that possibility? Do you think there is actually a little more strategy there?
Not at all, but I think it depends on, as I say, like the scale of the defeat. If it's really humbling and it's really, really difficult for them, do they then go down a, you know, rabbit hole of blame and hostility towards each other and lurch in one doomed direction? Or do they immediately think the mistake that they've made to date is not staying close enough to the centre, even while they're in government. So I think, it'll be really interesting to watch it all unfold, I think, after the election.
Yeah, from a Labour-y point of view, you know, I'd be quite happy if they chose one of the weirdos. But for the future of democracy and so on, yes, it would be great if they just went, why not someone normal?
Thank you.
reached the end of the show. So what are the stories that have gone under the radar this week? Alex?
So I wanted to mention Rees-Mogg admitting that the voter AD legislation was an attempt to gerrymander the vote.
Just incredible. He wasn't even on a hot mic.
I know.
It was like a normal mic.
And I know that it was discussed on Tuesday's edition, but I think the bit of it that has gone under the radar is that Rees-Mogg was in cabinet when that legislation was introduced. He wasn't some passive observer. He was actually leader of the House of Commons. He was responsible for driving this business through the House. And he was challenged on this by the opposition quite directly on whether this was an attempt to gerrymander. And he said, and I quote, that it's like being asked not to wear a hat when you go through borders. You know, it's just to avoid personation. It's a completely ordinary thing. So I think he should be hauled in front of the Standards and Privileges Committee and be made to account for misleading the House of Commons, because quite obviously he knew what this thing was. And just because it backfired, he's now saying, oh, wow, we really got that one wrong.
But that was incredible, because that very rarely happens. On election day, I was going, well, look, clearly it is voter suppression, whether it was meant to be or not, because voters are being suppressed. And I had some people on Twitter who were critical of that and said, absolute nonsense, blah, blah, blah.
Absolute nonsense. And what was the blah, blah, blah bit?
Blah, blah, blah. Angry. And then Mogg comes out and goes, yeah, that was it, but we suppressed the wrong voters.
Yeah, we fucked it. But, you know, he's on record, on Hansard.
Yeah.
At the time, driving that business, going, no, it's all in your mind. And that is fucking gaslighting.
We lost the local elections by mistake.
Matt?
Well, I don't know if you can say that AI is under the radar, but there was a...
it controls the radar.
Well, quite. There's the creator of ChatGPT, GPT, I keep calling it GBT, which is very different. He just keeps telling you that Brexit's great. ChatGPT, he was at a Senate hearing, and he has called for US senators to regulate AI, and so it's really important that they do this. And there does seem to be some bipartisan support for this, but you just feel like it's never in a polarized world of America, there's no way that it will be done effectively. They'll set up some toothless organization that in a couple of years' time will have no funding anymore.
And it will be run by AI.
Will it be run by an AI bot? Exactly.
And going, no, I judge myself to be properly correct on this issue.
Exactly. And I think the problem is, I saw a tweet, I tried to find it earlier, I couldn't find it again, but lots of people have expressed a similar feeling, that it does feel like we're getting AI to do like the wrong stuff, that, you know, we're in this place now where people are being asked to work hard in, you know, manual labor and stuff, and the robots aren't doing that. Robots are writing poems and making art, and like artists are being put out of business by AI, and musicians
and we're being asked to go pick fruit.
Exactly. And it feels like completely the wrong way around. In fact, I know somebody who works in the TV industry in the US, and they said that it's already, the studios are already thinking, well, give it 2 or 3 years, we'll be able to basically get AI to write scripts for all of those sort of procedural dramas, because we've had hundreds of episodes of NCIS or whatever, and we'll just put those in a box, the AI box, and then something will feed out of it. And I think it's a genuinely, you know, at the moment it's sort of funny typing into ChatGPT and seeing what it comes up with, and sometimes it's rubbish. But give it 2 or 3 years, it'll start being genuinely scary.
I won't even use it because it's the devil's work.
It's horrible.
Rachel, what's caught your eye this week?
Yeah, there's a really good story that The Guardian's covered about a Tory peer called Zamir Chowdhury in relation to No Fault Eviction, Section 21. So he's a billionaire Conservative Party landlord, and he used No Fault Eviction to throw out a tenant after his tenant refused a £1,600 annual rent increase after they reported mould and damp and what have you, and how sort of the state the property was in. We've got the Renters Reform Bill coming around, which is supposed to finally outlaw Section 21 No Fault Evictions. And I just wonder if this is the start of quite a few stories in this vein, because they've kind of said they were going to ban it and then have delayed it again and again and again. And I just wonder if this will be the first of many kind of scandals as to how renters have been treated.
Good stuff. Thanks, Rachel. I'm just going to do a very, very quick one. I just recommend, because I'm unfortunately obsessed with the mental disintegration of Elon Musk for my sins. And there's a remarkable interview, I think on CNBC, but it's just been going around, where he gets asked, you keep doing all this stuff, essentially white nationalist conspiracy theories. Do you not worry that this is hurting Twitter, losing Twitter advertisers, this is going to alienate sort of Tesla? And he almost pauses for 11 seconds, agonizing, and then very slowly starts describing a scene from The Princess Bride. where
that sounds amazing.
Where the, you know, the character, Mandy Patinkin's character, wants revenge, and then he's going, you know, offer me money, offer me power, you know, I shall have my revenge. And he's just going, well, I shall have my free speech. I will disseminate the theories of Cat Turd 2 if I want to, and I don't care about the money. Which I just thought is quite an extraordinary business move, but also the way that he was unprepared for the question, that he does not appear to be able to talk like a normal person or to have thought through any of the implications of saying that George Soros wants to destroy society. And I genuinely thought it's so becoming so Kanye-esque.
Yeah.
This sense of like, holy shit, like day by day, you're watching somebody whose brain, if we're talking about being very online, whose brain has been ruined by being too much on the company that he owns. Because remember Jack Dorsey, Twitter CEO? Yeah. He wasn't on Twitter that much. Mm. When he was just like, here's a picture of me, I'm just chilling.
He's forgotten the basic rule, which is don't get high on your own supply.
Exactly. Yeah. And now he is the equivalent of a sort of Twitter meth head.
Yeah.
check that out, because the 11-second pause is extraordinary. So thank you very much to Alex Andreu.
My pleasure.
Matt Green.
Thank you.
And Rachel Weirmouth.
Thank you.
Stay tuned for the extra bit after Demon is a Monster by Corner Shop, and a traditional thank you to our army of generous supporters. You too could join them and get the podcast early and without ads, plus lots more. And don't forget Oh God What Now live at Leicester Square Theatre on Wednesday the 24th of May. Tickets are out now and Patreon people get a discount. Search Oh God What Now Patreon to find out how to get yours.
A giant dollop of gratitude from me to Alison McCauley, Susan Schutjes, and Francesca.
And huge thanks for your support to Sebastian Schmeichek, Brian, and Lawrence Woodward.
Oh God, What Now? Is presented by Dorian Linsky with Alex Andreu. The group editor was Andrew Harrison. The managing editor was Jacob Jarvis. And the producers were Chris Jones and me, Alex Rees. Art direction by Mark Taylor and James Parrott. Oh God, What Now? Is a Podmasters production for ATN. We're here for you.
Welcome to the Extra Bit, exclusively for Patreon backers. Dum dum da dum 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 da 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 da. This week, we are discussing the America Decides episodes of Succession. Spoilers abound, so if you plan to watch it but haven't yet, like Rachel, who has stepped out, please stop listening now. Okay, so this all takes place on election night as Democrat Daniel Jimenez takes on fascistic Republican lizard man Jared Mencken. An arson attack on a vote counting station in Milwaukee throws the Wisconsin results into confusion, and the Roy family's Fox News-alike news operation ATN must decide whether to call it for Mencken, which ultimately means giving him the whole election. The road to fascism is paved with sweaty rich kid infighting. Alex, this episode took me right back to the trauma of election night 2016 and made me question whether I had the psychological fortitude to stay up in November 2024. Did it have that effect on you?
It left me genuinely shaken. Genuinely feeling quite nauseous.
Like you'd seen the real thing, right?
Like you'd seen how the sausage is made in such a disgusting way that it was. The problem with it was that it was a very credible version of what might be going on behind the scenes. And I know you say the 2016 election, but I thought what was very smart about it is that they had also mixed in all the Bush Junior Florida stuff.
Yeah.
So it had kind of merged both the 2016 and some of the stuff that happened in 2021 and some of the stuff that happened with Bush Jr. that first time when Florida was declared for him.
Well, although I forgot what a mess 2000 was. So I looked this up and I was like, oh, who did they call, you know, did it basically go to Bush because of networks? And networks called Florida for Gore based on exit polls early on. Then they retracted it. Then as the results came in, they called it for Bush. Then they retracted again and Gore withdrew his concession. Then he went to the Supreme Court, took a month. Obviously, they awarded it to Bush, hence the Iraq War and such like. But yet, it was much more complicated then. And it almost like...
And the absentee votes that were never counted. I read a book by a UN election observer that had a chapter on that 2000 election. And he was saying, if I had observed this in any Central African country, I would be crying foul. I would be saying this is outrageous.
Is that the problem, Matt, that one of the things it exposes, the poor decision desk guy?
Yeah.
Who gets wasabi in his eye.
and then lemonade.
The lemony water.
Not that lemony.
And not that lemony.
Little lemony.
Then he gets some... but he essentially gets overruled. And is there sort of something in the... you know, the median norms that you have to call it. You can't just go, do you know what? We don't know.
Yeah. Well, just going back to the 2000 election for a second, I was looking into it today. And
that was a teaser for the bonus bit of this week's podcast. If you would like to hear us gassing on about Succession and indeed a little bit more Oh God, What Now? Every week without ads and a day early, then sign up to back us on Patreon for as little as £3 a month. You'll also get our exclusive weekly mini-cast, Oh God, What Else? Every Monday morning and some fabulous merchandise. Thanks for listening and see you next week.